Random House Audio presents One Summer, America, 1927. This is the author, Bill Bryson. To Annie, Billy, and Gracie, and in memory of Julia Richardson. Prologue. On a warm spring evening, just before Easter 1927, people who lived in tall buildings in New York were given pause when wooden scaffolding around the tower of the brand-new Sherry Netherland apartment hotel caught fire, and it became evident that the city's firemen lacked any means to get water to such a height. Crowds flocked to Fifth Avenue to watch the blaze, the biggest the city had seen in years. At 38 stories, the Sherry Netherland was the tallest residential building ever erected, and the scaffolding, put there to facilitate the final stages of construction, covered the top 15 stories, providing enough wood to make a giant blaze around its summit. From a distance, the building looked rather like a just-struck match. The flames were visible 20 miles away. Up close, the scene was much more dramatic. Sections of burning scaffolding up to 50 feet long fell from a height of 500 feet and crashed in clattering showers of sparks in the streets below, to the gleeful cries of the spectators and the peril of toiling firemen. Burning embers dropped onto the roofs of neighboring buildings, setting four of them alight. Firemen trained their hoses on the Sherry Netherland building, but it was a token gesture, since their streams could not rise above the third or fourth story. Fortunately, the building was unfinished, and therefore unoccupied. People in 1920s America were unusually drawn to spectacle, and by 10 p.m. the crowd had grown to an estimated 100,000 people, an enormous gathering for a spontaneous event. 700 policemen had to be brought in to keep order. Some wealthy observers, deflected from their evening revels, took rooms in the Plaza Hotel across the street and held impromptu fire room parties, according to the New York Times. Mayor Jimmy Walker turned up to have a look and got soaked when he wandered into the path of a hose. A moment later, a flaming 10-foot-long plank crashed onto the pavement near him, and he accepted advice to withdraw. The fire did extensive damage to the upper reaches of the building, but luckily did not spread downwards and burned itself out about midnight. The flames and smoke provided some welcome diversion to two men, Clarence Chamberlain and Bert Acosta, who had been flying in circles in a small plane above Roosevelt Field on Long Island since 9:30 that morning. They were doing so in an attempt to break the world endurance record set 2 years earlier by two French aviators. This was partly a matter of national honor. America, birthplace of aviation, was now hopelessly behind even the smallest European nations, and partly to confirm that planes could stay up long enough to make long-distance flights. The trick of the exercise, Chamberlain explained afterwards, was to squeeze maximum mileage out of the plane by adjusting the throttle and fuel mixture to the point where the plane was just able to remain airborne, keeping it on starvation rations, as Chamberlain put it. When he and Acosta finally glided back to Earth shortly before 1 o'clock in the afternoon of their third day aloft, they were essentially flying on vapor. They had been continuously airborne for 51 hours, 11 minutes, and 25 seconds, an advance of nearly 6 hours on the existing record. They emerged grinning from their plane to the approving roar of a large crowd. People really did gather in enormous numbers for almost any event in the 1920s. The two triumphant pilots were tired and stiff and very thirsty. It turned out that one of their ground crew, in a moment of excited distraction, had left their canteens filled with soapy water, so they had had nothing to drink for 2 days. Otherwise, the flight was a great success, great enough to be the main story in the New York Times on Good Friday, April 15th. Across three columns, the headline declared, "Flyers set record of 51 hours in air, day and night without food or water, land worn but eager for Paris flight." They had flown 4,100 miles, 500 miles more than the distance from New York to Paris. Just as significantly, they had managed to get airborne with 375 gallons of fuel, an enormous load for the time, and had used up just 1,200 feet of runway to do so. All this was extremely encouraging for those who wished to fly the Atlantic. And in the spring of 1927, there were many, like Chamberlain and Acosta, who most assuredly did. By a curiously ironic twist, the event that left America far behind the rest of the world in aviation was the very one that assured its dominance in so many other spheres, the First World War. Before 1914, airplanes barely featured in military thinking. The French Air Corps, with 36 planes, was larger than all the other air forces in the world put together. Germany, Britain, Italy, Russia, Japan, and Austria all had no more than 4 planes in their fleets. The United States had just 2. But with the outbreak of fighting, military commanders quickly saw how useful planes could be. For monitoring enemy troop movements, for directing artillery fire, and above all, for providing a new direction and manner in which to kill people. In the early days, bombs often were nothing more than wine bottles filled with gasoline or kerosene, with a simple detonator attached, though a few pilots threw hand grenades, and some for a time dropped specially made darts called flechettes, which could pierce a helmet or otherwise bring pain and consternation to those in the trenches below. As always, where killing is involved, technological progress was swift, and by 1918, aerial bombs of up to 2,200 pounds were being dropped. Germany alone rained down 1 million individual bombs, some 27,000 tons of explosives, in the course of the war. Bombing was not terribly accurate. A bomb dropped from 10,000 feet rarely hit its target, and often missed by 0.5 mile or more. But the psychological effect, wherever a large bomb fell, was considerable. Heavy bomb loads required planes of ever greater size and power, which in turn spurred the development of swifter, nimbler fighter craft to defend or attack them, which in further turn produced the celebrated dogfights that fired the imaginations of schoolboys and set the tone for aviation for a generation to come. The air war produced an insatiable need for planes. In 4 years, the 4 main combatant nations spent $1 billion, a staggering sum, nearly all borrowed from America, on their air fleets. From almost nothing, France in 4 years built up an aircraft industry that employed nearly 200,000 people and produced some 70,000 planes. Britain built 55,000 planes, Germany 48,000, and Italy 20,000. Quite an advance, bearing in mind that only a few years earlier, the entire world aviation industry consisted of 2 brothers in a bicycle shop in Ohio. Up to 1914, the total number of people in the world who had been killed in airplanes was about 100. Now men died in their thousands. By the spring of 1917, the life expectancy of a British pilot was put at 8 days. Altogether, between 30,000 and 40,000 flyers were killed or injured to the point of incapacity in 4 years. Training was not a great deal safer than combat. At least 15,000 men were killed or invalided in accidents in flight schools. American flyers were particularly disadvantaged. When the United States entered the war in April 1917, not a single American military official had ever even seen a fighter aircraft, much less commanded one. When the explorer Hiram Bingham, discoverer of Machu Picchu, but now a middle-aged professor at Yale, offered himself as an instructor, the Army made him a lieutenant colonel and put him in charge of the whole training program, not because he had useful experience, he didn't, but simply because he knew how to fly a plane. Many new pilots were taught by instructors who had only just been taught themselves. America now made a huge but ultimately futile effort to catch up in aviation. Congress appropriated $600 million to build an air force. As Bingham wrote in his memoirs, "When we entered the war, the air service had 2 small flying fields, 48 officers, 1,330 men, and 225 planes, not one of which was fit to fly over the lines. In the course of 1.5 years, this air service grew to 50 flying fields, 20,500 officers, 175,000 men, and 17,000 planes." Unfortunately, almost none of those 17,000 planes reached Europe, because nearly all available shipping was needed for troops. So American airmen, when they got to the front, mostly flew in borrowed, patched-up planes provided by the Allies. And thus, they were sent into the most dangerous form of combat in modern times, with next to no training, in generally second-rate surplus planes against vastly more experienced enemies. Yet at no point was there a shortage of volunteer pilots on any side. The ability to climb to 13,000 feet, to fly at 130 miles an hour, to roll and dart and swoop through the air in deadly combat was for many airmen thrilling to the point of addiction. The romance and glamour of it can scarcely be imagined now. Pilots were the most heroic figures of the age. Then the war ended, and planes and aviators both were suddenly, largely worthless. America terminated $100 million of aircraft orders at a stroke, and essentially lost all official interest in flying. Other nations scaled back nearly as severely. For aviators who wished to remain airborne, the options were stark and few. Many, lacking anything better to do, engaged in stunts. In Paris, the Galerie Lafayette department store, in a moment of unconsidered folly, offered a prize of 25,000 francs to anyone who could land a plane on its roof. A more foolhardy challenge could hardly be imagined. The roof was just 30 yards long and bounded by a 3-foot-high balustrade, which added several perilous degrees of steepness to any landing on it. A former war ace named Jules Vedrin decided nonetheless to have a try. Vedrin placed men on the roof to grab the wings of his plane as it came in. The men succeeded in keeping the plane from tumbling off the roof and onto the festive throngs in the Place de l'Opera below, but only at the cost of directing it into a brick shed housing the store's elevator mechanisms. The plane was smashed to splinters, but Vedrin stepped from the wreckage unscathed, like a magician from an amazing trick. Such luck, however, couldn't hold. 3 months later, he died in a crash while trying to fly, more conventionally, from Paris to Rome. Vedrin's death in a French field illustrated two awkward facts about airplanes. For all their improvements in speed and maneuverability, they were still dangerous devices and not much good for distances. Just a month after his crash, the U.S. Navy unwittingly underscored the point when it sent 3 Curtiss flying boats on a hair-raisingly ill-conceived trip from Newfoundland to Portugal via the Azores. In readiness, the Navy positioned 66 ships along the route to steam to the aid of any plane that got into trouble, which suggests that its own confidence in the exercise was perhaps less than total. It was as well that it took precautions. One of the planes ditched in the sea and had to be rescued before it even got to Newfoundland. The other 2 planes splashed down prematurely during the race itself and had to be towed to the Azores. One of those sank en route. Of the 3 planes that set out, only 1 made it to Portugal, and that took 11 days. Had the purpose of the exercise been to show how unready for ocean flights airplanes were, it could not have been more successful. Crossing the ocean in a single leap seemed a wholly unachievable ambition. So when 2 British airmen did just that in the summer of 1919, it was quite a surprise to everyone, including, it seems, the airmen. Their names were Jack Alcock and Arthur Witten Teddy Brown, and they deserved to be a good deal more famous. Their flight was one of the most daring in history, but sadly forgotten now. It wasn't particularly well noted at the time, either. Alcock, aged 26, was the pilot, and Brown, 33, the navigator. Both men had grown up in Manchester, England, though Brown was the child of American parents. His father had been sent to Britain in the early 1900s to build a factory for Westinghouse, and the family had stayed on. Though Brown had never lived in America, he spoke with an American accent, and only recently had given up his American citizenship. He and Alcock barely knew each other, and had only flown together 3 times when they squeezed into the open cockpit of a frail and boxy Vickers Vimy airplane in June 1919 at St. John's in Newfoundland, and headed out of the forbidding grey void of the Atlantic. Footnote. The Vickers Vimy hangs in the Science Museum in London, but few notice it. A monument to Alcock and Brown at Heathrow Airport wasn't erected until 35 years after their flight. When I checked out Graham Wallace's classic account of the trip, The Flight of Alcock and Brown, 14th to 15th June 1919, from the London Library, I was the first person in 17 years to do so. Perhaps never have flyers braved greater perils in a less substantial craft. The Vickers Vimy was little more than a box kite with a motor. For hours, Alcock and Brown flew through the wildest weather, through rain and hail and driving snow. Lightning lit the clouds around them, and winds tossed them violently in all directions. An exhaust pipe split and sent flames licking along the plane's fabric covering to their understandable alarm. 6 times Brown had to crawl out onto the wings to clear air intakes of ice with his bare hands. Much of the rest of the time he spent wiping Alcock's goggles, since Alcock couldn't for a moment relax his grip on the controls. Flying through cloud and fog, they lost all orientation. Emerging into clear air at one point, they were astounded to find that they were just 60 feet above the water and flying sideways at a 90-degree angle to the surface. In one of the few spells when Brown was able to navigate, he discovered that they had somehow turned around and were heading back to Canada. There really has never been a more hair-raising seat-of-the-pants flight. After 16 hours of bouncing disorder, Ireland miraculously appeared beneath them, and Alcock crash-landed in a boggy field. They had flown 1,890 miles, only slightly more than half the distance from New York to Paris, but it was still an astounding achievement. They emerged unhurt from their mangled plane, but struggled to get anyone to grasp quite what they had just done. Word of their departure from Newfoundland had been delayed, so no one in Ireland was expecting their arrival, removing all sense of excitement and anticipation. The telegraph girl in Clifton, the nearest town, was not terribly good at her job, it seems, and could only manage to transmit short, mildly befuddled messages, adding to the confusion. When Alcock and Brown managed to get back to England, they were given heroes' welcomes. Medals were bestowed, the king gave them knighthoods, but they quickly returned to their quiet previous lives, and the world forgot all about them. 6 months later, Alcock died in a flying accident in France when he crashed into a tree in fog. Brown never flew again. By 1927, when flying the Atlantic Ocean became an earnest dream, their names were hardly remembered. Entirely coincidentally, at almost exactly the same time that Alcock and Brown were making their milestone flight, a businessman in New York, who had no connection to aviation at all, he just liked planes, made an offer that transformed the world of flying and created what became known as the Great Atlantic Air Derby. The man's name was Raymond Ortig. He was from France originally, but was now a successful hotelier in New York. Inspired by the exploits of First World War aviators, Ortig offered a prize of $25,000 to the first person or persons who could fly nonstop from New York to Paris, or vice versa, in the next 5 years. It was a generous offer, but an entirely safe one, since it was patently beyond the scope of any airplane to cover such a span in a single flight. As Alcock and Brown painfully proved, just flying half that distance was at the very bounds of technology and good fortune. No one took up Ortig's offer, but in 1924 he renewed it, and now it was beginning to seem actually possible. The development of air-cooled engines, America's one outstanding contribution to aviation technology in the period, gave planes greater range and reliability. The world also had an abundance of talented, often brilliant, nearly always severely underemployed, aeronautic engineers and designers who were eager to show what they could do. For many, winning the Ortig Prize wasn't merely the best challenge around, it was the only one. The first to try was the great French aviator René Fonck, in partnership with the Russian émigré designer Igor Sikorsky. No one needed the success more than Sikorsky did. He had been a leading airplane designer in Europe, but in 1917 had lost everything in the Russian Revolution and fled to America. Now, in 1926, at the age of 37, he supported himself by teaching chemistry and physics to fellow immigrants and by building planes when he could. Sikorsky loved a well-appointed airplane. One of his pre-war models included a washroom and promenade deck, a somewhat generous description, it must be said, and the plane he now built for the Atlantic flight was the plushest of all. It had leather fittings, a sofa and chairs, cooking facilities, even a bed. Everything that a crew of four could possibly want in the way of comfort and elegance. The idea was to show that the Atlantic could not simply be crossed, but crossed in style. Sikorsky was supported by a syndicate of investors who called themselves the Argonauts. For a pilot, they chose René Fonck, France's greatest war ace. Fonck had shot down 75 German planes. He claimed it was over 120, an achievement all the more remarkable for the fact that he had flown only for the last 2 years of the war. He spent the first two digging ditches before persuading the French Air Service to give him a chance at flight school. Fonck was adroit at knocking down enemy planes, but even more incomparably skilled at eluding damage himself. In all his battles, Fonck's own plane was struck by an enemy bullet just once. Unfortunately, the skills and temperament needed for combat are not necessarily the ones required to fly an airplane successfully across a large and empty sea. Fonck now showed no common sense in regard to preparations. First, he insisted on going before the plane was adequately tested, to Sikorsky's despair. Next, and even worse, he grossly overloaded it. He packed extra fuel, an abundance of emergency equipment, two kinds of radios, spare clothes, presents for friends and supporters, and lots to eat and drink, including wines and champagne. He even packed a dinner of terrapin, turkey, and duck to be prepared and eaten in celebration after reaching Paris, as if France could not be counted on to feed them. Altogether, the plane, when loaded, weighed 28,000 pounds, far more than it was designed or probably able to lift. On September 20th came news that two Frenchmen, Major Pierre Weiss and a Lieutenant Chalet, had flown in a single leap from Paris to Bandar Abbas in Persia, now Iran, a distance of 3,230 miles, almost as far as from New York to Paris. Elated at this demonstration of the innate superiority of French aviators, Fonck insisted on immediate preparation for departure. Thus it was that the following morning, before a large crowd, the Sikorsky, which, such was the rush, hadn't even been given a name, was rolled into position and its three mighty silver engines started. Almost from the moment it began lumbering down the runway, things didn't look right. Airfields in the 1920s were essentially just that, fields, and Roosevelt Field was no better than most. Because the plane needed an especially long run, it had to cross two dirt service roads, neither of which had been rolled smooth, a painful reminder of how imprudently overhasty the entire operation was. As the Sikorsky jounced at speed over the second of the tracks, a section of landing gear fell off, damaging the left rudder, and a detached wheel went bouncing off into oblivion. Fonck pressed on nonetheless, opening the throttle and continually gaining speed until he was almost going fast enough to get airborne. Alas, almost was not good enough. Thousands of hands went to mouths as the plane reached the runway's end, never having left the ground even fractionally, and tumbled clumsily over a 20-foot embankment, vanishing from view. For some moments, the watching crowd stood in a stunned and eerie silence. Birdsong could be heard, giving an air of peacefulness obviously at odds with the catastrophe just witnessed. And then awful normality reasserted itself with an enormous gaseous explosion as 2,850 gallons of aviation fuel combusted, throwing a fireball 50 feet into the air. Fonck and his navigator, Lawrence Curtin, somehow managed to scramble free, but the other two crew members were incinerated in their seats. The incident horrified the flying fraternity. The rest of the world was horrified too, but at the same time, morbidly eager for more. For Sikorsky, the blow was economic as well as emotional. The plane had cost more than $100,000 to build, but his backers had so far paid only a fraction of that, and now, the plane gone, they declined to pay the rest. Sikorsky would eventually find a new career building helicopters, but for now, he and Fonck, their plane, and their dreams were finished. For the time being, it was too late for other ocean flyers as well. Weather patterns meant that flights over the North Atlantic were only safely possible for a few months each year. Everyone would have to wait now until the following spring. Spring came. America had three teams in the running, all with excellent planes and experienced crews. The names of the planes alone, Columbia, America, American Legion, showed how much this had become a matter of national pride. The initial front-runner was the Columbia, the monoplane in which Chamberlain and Acosta had set their endurance record just before Easter. But 2 days after that milestone flight, an even more impressive and vastly more expensive plane was wheeled out of its factory at Hasbrook Heights, New Jersey. This was the America, which carried three powerful, roaring engines and had space for a crew of four. The leader of the America team was 37-year-old Naval Commander Richard Evelyn Byrd, a man seemingly born to be a hero. Suave and handsome, he came from one of America's oldest and most distinguished families. The Byrds had been dominant in Virginia since the time of George Washington. Byrd's brother Harry was governor of the state. Richard Byrd himself was already a celebrated adventurer in 1927. The previous spring, with the pilot Floyd Bennett, he had made the first flight in an airplane over the North Pole, though in fact, as we will see, there have long been doubts that he actually did so. Byrd's present expedition was also by far the best funded and most self-proclaimedly patriotic, thanks to Rodman Wanamaker, owner of department stores in Philadelphia and New York, who had put up $500,000 of his own money and gathered additional unspecified funding from other leading businessmen. Through Wanamaker, Byrd now controlled the leasehold on Roosevelt Field, the only airfield in New York with a runway long enough to accommodate any plane built to fly the Atlantic. Without Byrd's permission, no one else could even consider going for the Ortig Prize. Wanamaker insisted that the operation be all-American. This was a little ironic, because the plane's designer, a strong-willed and difficult fellow named Anthony Fokker, was Dutch, and the plane itself had partly been built in Holland. Even worse, though rarely mentioned, was that Fokker had spent the war years in Germany building planes for the Germans. He had even taken out German citizenship. As part of his commitment to German air superiority, he had invented the synchronized machine gun, which enabled bullets to pass between the spinning blades of a propeller. Before this, amazingly, all that aircraft manufacturers could do was wrap armor plating around the propellers and hope that any bullets that struck the blades weren't deflected backwards. The only alternative was to mount the guns away from the propeller, but that meant pilots couldn't reload them or clear jams, which were frequent. Fokker's gun gave German pilots a deadly advantage for some time and made him probably responsible for more Allied deaths than any other individual. Now, however, he insisted that he had never actually been on Germany's side. My own country remained neutral throughout the entire course of the Great Conflict, and in a definite sense, so did I, he wrote in his post-war autobiography, Flying Dutchman. He never explained in what sense he thought himself neutral. No doubt because there wasn't any sense in which he was. Byrd never liked Fokker, and now, in April 1927, their enmity became complete. Just before 6 PM, Fokker and three members of the Byrd team, the co-pilot Floyd Bennett, the navigator George Noville, and Byrd himself, eagerly crowded into the cockpit. Fokker took the controls for this maiden flight. The plane took off smoothly and performed faultlessly in the air. But as the America came into land, it became evident that it was impelled by the inescapable burden of gravity to tip forward and come down nose first. The problem was that all the weight was up front, and there was no way for any of the four men on board to move to the back to redistribute the load, because a large fuel tank entirely filled the middle part of the fuselage. Fokker circled around the airfield while he considered his options, or rather considered that he had no options, and came into land as gingerly as he could. What exactly happened next became at once a matter of heated dispute. Byrd maintained that Fokker abandoned the controls and made every effort to save himself, leaving the others to their fates. Fokker vehemently denied this. Jumping out of a crashing plane was not possible, he said. Maybe Bird was excited and imagined this, Fokker wrote with pained sarcasm in his autobiography. Surviving film footage of the crash, which is both brief and grainy, shows the plane landing roughly, tipping onto its nose, and flopping onto its back, all in a continuous motion, like a child doing a somersault. Fokker, like all the other occupants, could have done nothing but brace and hold on. In the footage, the damage looks slight, but inside all was violent chaos. A piece of propeller ripped through the cockpit and pierced Bennett's chest. He was bleeding profusely and critically injured. Noville, painfully mindful of the fire that had killed two of Fonk's men, punched his way out through the plane's fabric covering. Bird followed, and was so furious with Fokker that he reportedly failed to notice that his left arm had snapped like a twig and was dangling in a queasily unnatural way. Fokker, uninjured, stood and shouted back at Bird, blaming him for overloading the plane on its first flight. The episode introduced serious rancor into the Bird camp and set back the team's plans by weeks. Bennett was rushed to a hospital at Hackensack, where he lay close to death for the next 10 days. He was lost to the team for good. The plane had to be almost completely rebuilt, and indeed extensively redesigned, to allow the weight to be distributed more sensibly. For the time being, the Bird team was out of the running. That left two other American planes, but fate, alas, was not on their sides either. On April the 24th, 8 days after the Bird crash, Clarence Chamberlain was prevailed upon to take the 9-year-old daughter of the plane's owner, Charles A. Levine, and the daughter of an official from the Brooklyn Chamber of Commerce, up for a short flight above Long Island. Chamberlain's young passengers got a more exciting flight than they expected, because the landing gear fell apart during takeoff, leaving one wheel behind, which meant he had only one wheel to land on. Chamberlain made a nearly perfect landing, without injury to himself or his passengers. But the wing hit the ground, and the damage to the plane was sufficient to set back the Columbia's plans considerably. Hopes now turned to two popular naval officers at the Hampton Roads Naval Air Base in Virginia, Noel Davis and Stanton H. Wooster. Davis and Wooster were smart, able aviators, and their plane, a Keystone Pathfinder built in Bristol, Pennsylvania, was gleamingly new and powered by 3 Wright Whirlwind engines. What the outside world didn't know, however, was that upon delivery, the plane turned out to weigh 1,150 pounds more than it was supposed to. Davis and Wooster took the plane up in a series of test flights, each time cautiously increasing the fuel load, and so far had experienced no problems. On April 26th, 2 days after Chamberlain's emergency landing, they scheduled their final test flight. This time they would take off with a full load of 17,000 pounds, nearly a quarter more than the plane had attempted to lift before. Among those who came to cheer them on were Davis's young wife, their infant son in her arms, and Wooster's fiancée. This time the plane struggled to get airborne. At length it rose into the air, but not enough to clear a line of trees at the far side of a neighboring field. Wooster banked sharply. The plane stalled and fell to earth with a sickening crash. Davis and Wooster died instantly. America, for the time being at least, was out of contenders. To make matters worse, things were going rather well for foreigners. While the American flyers were investing all their energies in land planes, the Italians had taken another tack. They saw seaplanes as the way of the future. Seaplanes had much to commend them. They eliminated the need for landing fields, since they could put down on any convenient body of water. Seaplanes could island hop their way across oceans, follow rivers deep into jungly continents, stop at coastal communities with no clearings for airstrips, and otherwise go where conventional airplanes could not. No one demonstrated the versatility and usefulness of seaplanes better than the Italian aviator Francesco di Pinedo. The son of a lawyer from Naples, Pinedo was well-educated and headed for a career in the professions when he discovered flying. It became his life. In 1925, Accompanied by a mechanic named Ernesto Campanelli, Pinedo flew from Italy to Australia and back via Japan. They did it in comparatively short hops, always sticking close to land, and the trip took 7 months to complete, but it was still a voyage of 34,000 miles, epic by any standards. Pinedo became a national hero. Benito Mussolini, who had come to power in 1922, showered him with honors. Mussolini was enthralled by flight, by its speed and daring and promise of technological superiority. All of those qualities were magically personified, in his view, by the stout little Neapolitan, who became his emissary of the air. Time magazine, 4 years old and enchanted with stereotype, described Pinedo in the spring of 1927 as a swart fascist ace. Almost anyone from south of the Alps was swart in Time magazine. Pinedo was, in fact, not especially swart, and not at all an ace. He had spent the war flying reconnaissance missions. But he was indeed a loyal fascist. With his black shirt, brilliantined hair, thrusting jaw, and habit of standing with his fists pinned to his hips, Pinedo was, to an almost comical degree, the very model of a strutting, self-satisfied fascist. This was not a problem to anyone so long as he stayed in Europe. But in the spring of 1927, he came to America. Worse, he did it in the most heroic way possible. While America's Atlantic hopefuls were struggling to get their planes ready, Pinedo efficiently made his way to the United States via coastal Africa, the Cape Verde Islands, South America, and the Caribbean. It was the first westward crossing by airplane of the Atlantic Ocean, a feat in itself, even if it was not done in a single bound. Pinedo reached the United States in late March at New Orleans and began a lavish, if not always wholly welcome, progress around the country. It was hard to decide what to make of him. On the one hand, he was unquestionably a gifted flyer and entitled to a parade or two. On the other, he was a representative of an obnoxious form of government that was admired by many Italian immigrants who were thus deemed to represent a threat to the American way of life. At a time when America's air efforts were suffering one setback after another, Pinedo's prolonged victory lap around the country began to seem just a little insensitive. After New Orleans, Pinedo proceeded west to California, stopping at Galveston, San Antonio, Hot Springs, and other communities along the way to refuel and receive ovations from small bands of supporters and a rather larger number of the merely curious. On April 6th, en route to a civic reception in San Diego, he landed at a reservoir called Roosevelt Lake in the desert west of Phoenix. Even in this lonely spot, a crowd gathered. As the observers respectfully watched the plane being serviced, a youth named John Thomason lit a cigarette and unthinkingly tossed the match on the water. The water, coated with oil and aviation fuel, ignited with a mighty whoomph that made everyone scatter. Within seconds, Pinedo's beloved plane was engulfed in flames and workmen were swimming for their lives. Pinedo, having lunch at a lakeside hotel, looked up from his meal to see smoke where his plane should be. The plane was entirely destroyed but for the engine, which sank to the lake bottom 60 feet below. The Italian press, already hypersensitive to anti-fascist sentiment in America, concluded that this was an act of treacherous sabotage. "Vile crime against fascism," one paper cried in a headline. "Odious act of anti-fascists," echoed another. America's ambassador to Italy, Henry P. Fletcher, made matters even worse by dashing off a letter of apology to Mussolini, in which he described the fire as an act of criminal folly and promised that the guilty will be discovered and severely punished. For days afterwards, a Times correspondent reported from Rome, the citizens of Italy talked of little else but this catastrophic setback to their hero, their superman, their demigod, De Pinedo. Eventually, all sides calmed down and accepted that the act was an accident. But suspicion simmered, and henceforth Pinedo, his crew, and his possessions were guarded by menacing fascisti volunteers armed with stilettos and truncheons. Pinedo left his lieutenants to haul the dripping engine from the lake and get it dried out while he headed east to New York to await delivery of a substitute plane from Italy that Mussolini promised to dispatch at once. He could have no idea of it, of course, but his troubles, in life and in the air, had only just begun. The world's attention moved to Paris, where at dawn on May 8th, two slightly aging men in bulky flying suits emerged from an administration building at Le Bourget airfield to the respectful applause of well-wishers. The men, Captain Charles Neumgesser and Captain Francois Colly, walked stiffly and a little self-consciously. Their heavy gear, which was necessary because they were about to fly 3,600 miles in an open cockpit, made them look almost uncannily like little boys in snowsuits. Many of their well-wishers had been out all night and were still in evening dress. The New York Times likened the scene to a garden party. Among those who had come to see them off were Neumgesser's pal, the boxer George Carpentier, and the singer Maurice Chevalier, with his mistress, a celebrated chanteuse and film actress who went by the single sultry name Miss Dengay. Neumgesser and Colly were war heroes and normally sauntered about with the smooth and cocky air of men at ease with danger. But today was a little different. Colly, at 46, was a venerable figure. Not many airmen were still alive and flying at 46. He wore a rakish black monocle over a missing right eye, one of five wounds he had sustained in combat. This was nothing compared with Neumgesser's extravagant affinity for injury, however. No one in the war was injured more, or at least got up again afterwards. Neumgesser had so many injuries that after the war he listed them all on his business card. They included 6 jaw fractures, 4 upper, 2 lower, fractured skull and palate, bullet wounds to mouth and ear, dislocations of wrist, clavicle, ankle, and knees, loss of teeth, shrapnel wound to upper body, multiple concussions, multiple leg fractures, multiple internal injuries, and contusions too numerous to list. He was also gravely injured in a car crash in which a companion died. Often he was so banged up that he had to be carried to his plane by crew members and gently inserted into the cockpit. Despite his injuries, Neumgesser shot down 44 planes. He claimed many more, a number exceeded among French aviators only by René Fonck, and received so many medals that he all but clanked when he walked. He listed those on his business card, too. As with so many airmen, armistice left him at something of a loss. He worked for a time as a gaucho in Argentina, gave flying demonstrations in America with his friend the Marquis de Charette, and starred in a movie called The Sky Raiders, filmed at Roosevelt Field in New York, where the Ortig Prize competitors were gathering now. With his Gallic charm and chest full of medals, Neumgesser proved irresistible to women, and in the spring of 1923, after a whirlwind romance, he became engaged to a young New York socialite with the unimprovably glorious name of Consuelo Hatmaker. Miss Hatmaker, who was just 19, came from a long line of lively women. Her mother, the former Nellie Sands, was a celebrated beauty who proved too great a handful for 3 husbands, including the eponymous Mr. Hatmaker, whom she discarded in a divorce in 1921. This bewildered but well-meaning gentleman opposed his daughter's marriage to Captain Neumgesser on the grounds, not unreasonable on the face of it, that Neumgesser was destitute, broken-bodied, something of a bounder, unemployable except in time of war, and French. In this, however, Mr. Hatmaker was unsupported by his former wife, who not only endorsed the marriage, but announced that she would at the same time marry her own latest paramour, Captain William Waters, an American of amiable anonymity, who seems to have aroused the passing interest of the world just twice in his life, once when he married Mrs. Hatmaker, and once when they divorced a few years later. So mother and daughter were wed in a joint ceremony in Dinard, in Brittany, not far from where Charles Neumgesser would get his last glimpse of his native soil in the spring of 1927. Consuelo and Charles's marriage was not a success. She declared at the outset that she would not live in France, while he disdained to live anywhere else. They parted swiftly and were divorced in 1926. But Noongesser clearly had second thoughts, because he now mused aloud to friends that a heroic gesture might help to reunite him with the luscious Consuelo and her no less luscious fortune. Noongesser was aided in his ambitions by the misfortunes of Fonck, whose crash the previous fall had helped Noongesser persuade Pierre Levasseur, an aircraft manufacturer, to provide him with the plane as a restorative to French pride. A prize endowed by a Frenchman and won by French flyers in a French machine would obviously be a boost to French prestige. Colley gladly joined the enterprise as navigator. They called their plane L'Oiseau Blanc, the White Bird, and painted it white so that it would be easier to find if it came down in the sea. Starting in Paris was a piece of patriotic vanity that many were certain would prove their undoing. It would mean flying into prevailing winds that would slow their speed and cut their fuel efficiency dramatically. The engine was a water-cooled Lorraine Dietrich, the same make Pinedo had used to fly to Australia, so it had a pedigree. But it was not an engine built with long ocean crossings in mind. In any case, they could carry no more than about 40 hours' worth of fuel, which left them almost no margin for error. Noongesser seemed to know that what they hoped to achieve was probably not possible. As he moved around his plane on May 8th, he smiled weakly at well-wishers and seemed distracted. To boost his alertness, he accepted an intravenous injection of caffeine, which cannot have done his nerves any good. Coley, by contrast, appeared entirely relaxed, but agreed with Noongesser that the plane was overloaded and should be lightened. They decided to discard most of their rations, as well as their life jackets and an inflatable dinghy. If forced down, they had nothing now to aid their survival but a contraption for distilling seawater, a length of fishing line and a hook, and a small, curious assortment of food. 3 cans of tuna and 1 of sardines, 12 bananas, 1 kilo of sugar, 1 flask of hot coffee, and brandy. Even after unloading supplies, their plane weighed almost 11,000 pounds. It had never taken off with that much weight before. When preparations were complete, Coley and his wife embraced. Then he and Noongesser waved to their well-wishers and clambered aboard. It was 5:15 a.m. when they assumed their takeoff position. The runway at Le Bourget was 2 miles long, and they would need nearly all of it. The plane crossed the grass expanse with fearful sluggishness at first, but slowly gathered speed. After some time, it lifted briefly, but came down again, and bouncily proceeded another 300 yards, before finally, agonizingly, and barely getting airborne. The chief engineer, who had run along beside the plane much of the way, fell to his knees and wept. Just taking off was a unique triumph. No plane in the Atlantic race had done even that before now. The crowd roared its approval. The White Bird climbed with painful slowness into the milky haze of the western sky and set a course for the English Channel. 1 hour and 27 minutes later, at 6:48 a.m., Noongesser and Coley reached the chalky sea cliffs of Normandy at Etretat. A squadron of 4 escort planes tipped their wings in salute and peeled away, and L'Oiseau Blanc flew off alone in the direction of the British Isles and the cold Atlantic beyond. All France waited breathlessly. The following day came the joyous news that the 2 airmen had made it. Noongesser et arrive, the Parisian newspaper L'Intransigeant announced excitedly, so excitedly that it put a circumflex rather than an acute accent on arrivé. A rival publication, Paris Press, quoted Noongesser's first words to the American people upon landing. According to this report, Noongesser had made a smooth and stylish landing in New York Harbor and brought the plane to a halt before the Statue of Liberty, also from France, as the paper proudly noted. Once ashore, the 2 aviators were greeted by a deliriously impressed and jubilant city and showered with ticker tape as they paraded up Fifth Avenue. In Paris, the happy news all but stopped the city. Bells rang out, strangers weepily embraced, crowds gathered around anyone who had a newspaper. Levasseur sent a telegram of congratulations. At Coley's mother's home in Marseille, champagne was broken out, I knew my boy would do it because he told me he would, Coley's mother said, tears of joy and relief shining on her cheeks. Soon, however, it emerged that the two news stories were not just mistaken, but sadly imaginary. Neugesser and Coley had not arrived in New York at all. They were, in fact, missing and feared lost. An enormous ocean manhunt at once swung into action. Naval ships were dispatched and merchant vessels instructed to keep a sharp lookout. The Navy dirigible USS Los Angeles was ordered to search from the air. The passenger liner France, en route to New York from Le Havre, received instructions from the French government to take a more northerly course than normal, despite the risk of icebergs, in the hope of coming across the floating white bird. At Roosevelt Field, Rodman Wanamaker offered $25,000 to anyone who could find the missing aviators, dead or alive. For a day or so, people clung to the hope that Neugesser and Coley would at any moment putter triumphantly into view. But every passing hour counted against them, and now the weather, already grim, turned dire. Dense fog settled over the eastern Atlantic and blanketed the North American seaboard from Labrador to the mid-Atlantic states. At Ambrose Light, a floating lighthouse off the mouth of New York Harbor, the keeper reported that thousands of birds lost on their annual migration north were sheltering bleakly on every surface they could cling to. At Sandy Hook, New Jersey, four searchlights endlessly but pointlessly swept the skies, their beams unable to penetrate the enshrouding murk. In Newfoundland, temperatures plunged and a light snow fell. Unaware that the flyers had jettisoned reserve supplies at the last moment, commentators noted that Neugesser and Coley had packed enough food to sustain them for weeks, and that their plane was designed to stay afloat indefinitely. It wasn't. Many people took hope from the fact that 2 years earlier, an American aviator, Commander John Rogers, and three crewmen spent 9 days floating in the Pacific, presumed dead, before being rescued by a submarine after failing to fly from California to Hawaii. Rumors now put Neugesser and Coley all over the place. In Iceland, in Labrador, scooped from the sea by any of several passing ships. Three people in Ireland reported seeing them, which gave some people heart, while others reflected that three sightings was not many in a nation of 3 million. 16 people in Newfoundland, mostly in or around Harbour Grace, reported hearing or seeing a plane, though none could give a positive identification, and other similar reports drifted in from Nova Scotia, Maine, New Hampshire, and as far south as Port Washington, Long Island. A Canadian trapper came in with a message signed by Neugesser, but on examination, the message proved to be suspiciously illiterate and in a hand quite unlike Neugesser's, but very like the trapper's own. Messages in bottles were found, too, and were still turning up as late as 1934. The one thing that wasn't found was any trace of the white bird or its occupants. In France, a rumor circulated that the U.S. Weather Bureau had withheld crucial information from the Frenchmen to keep the advantage with the American flyers. Myron Herrick, the American ambassador, cabled Washington that an American flight at this time would be unwise. It was altogether a wretched week for French aviation. At the same time as Neugesser and Coley's flight from Le Bourget, another ambitious French flight, now forgotten by the rest of the world and hardly noticed even then, got underway when three aviators, Pierre de Saint-Romain, Hervé Meunier, and Louis Petit, took off from Senegal on the west coast of Africa and headed for Brazil. When just 120 miles from the Brazilian coast, they radioed the happy news that they would be arriving in just over an hour, or so a correspondent for Time magazine reported. That was the last anyone ever heard from them. No wreckage was ever found. In 9 months, 11 people had died in the quest to fly the Atlantic. It was just at this point, when nothing was going right for anyone, that a gangly young man known as Slim flew in from the West and announced his plan to fly the ocean alone. His name was Charles Lindbergh. A most extraordinary summer was about to begin. May, the Kid. In the spring of 27, something bright and alien flashed across the sky. F. Scott Fitzgerald, My Lost City. Chapter 1. 10 days before he became so famous that crowds would form around any building that contained him, and waiters would fight over a corncob left on his dinner plate, no one had heard of Charles Lindbergh. The New York Times had mentioned him once in the context of the coming Atlantic flights. It had misspelled his name. The news that transfixed the nation as spring gave way to summer in 1927 was of a gruesome murder in a modest family home on Long Island, coincidentally quite close to Roosevelt Field, where the Atlantic Flyers were now gathering. The newspapers, much excited, called it the Sashwaite Murder Case. The story was this. Late on the night of March 20, 1927, as Mr. and Mrs. Albert Snyder slept side by side in twin beds in their house on 222nd Street, in a quiet middle-class neighborhood of Queens Village, Mrs. Snyder heard noises in the upstairs hallway. Going to investigate, she found a large man, a giant, she told police, just outside her bedroom door. He was speaking in a foreign accent to another man whom she could not see. Before Mrs. Snyder could react, the giant seized her and beat her so roughly that she was left unconscious for 6 hours. Then he and his confederate went to Mr. Snyder's bed, strangled the poor man with picture wire, and stove in his head with a sash weight from a window. It was the sash weight that fired the public's imagination and gave the case its name. The two villains then turned out drawers all over the house and fled with Mrs. Snyder's jewels, but they left a clue to their identity in the form of an Italian-language newspaper on a table downstairs. The New York Times the next day was fascinated but confused. In a big page-one headline it reported, "Art editor is slain in bed. Wife tied, home searched. Motive mystifies police." The story noted that a Dr. Vincent Juster from St. Mary Immaculate Hospital had examined Mrs. Snyder and couldn't find any bump on her that would explain her 6 hours of unconsciousness. Indeed, he couldn't find any injuries on her at all. Perhaps, he suggested tentatively, it was the trauma of the event rather than actual injury that accounted for her prolonged collapse. Police detectives by this time, however, were more suspicious than confused. For one thing, the Snyder house showed no sign of forced entry, and in any case it was an oddly modest target for murderous jewel thieves. The detectives found it curious, too, that Albert Snyder had slept through a violent scuffle just outside his door. The Snyder's 9-year-old daughter, Lorraine, in a room across the hall, had also heard nothing. It also seemed strange that burglars would break into a house and evidently pause to read an anarchist newspaper before placing it neatly on a table and proceeding upstairs. Oddest of all, Mrs. Snyder's bed, the one from which she had risen to investigate the noise in the hallway, was tidily made, as if it had not been slept in. She was unable to account for this, citing her concussion. As the detectives puzzled over these anomalies, one of them idly lifted a corner of the mattress on Mrs. Snyder's bed, and there revealed the jewels that she had reported stolen. All eyes turned to Mrs. Snyder. She met their gazes uncertainly, then broke down and confessed the crime, but blamed it all on a brute named Judd Gray, her secret lover. Mrs. Snyder was placed under arrest, a search was begun for Judd Gray, and the newspaper-reading public of America was about to become uncommonly excited. The 1920s was a great time for reading altogether, very possibly the peak decade for reading in American life. Soon it would be overtaken by the passive distractions of radio. But for the moment, reading remained for most people the principal method for filling idle time. Each year, American publishers produced 110 million books, more than 10,000 separate titles, double the number of 10 years before. For those who felt daunted by such a welter of literary possibility, a helpful new phenomenon, the book club, had just made its debut. The Book of the Month Club was founded in 1926 and was followed the next year by the Literary Guild. Both were immediately successful. Authors were venerated in a way that seems scarcely possible now. When Sinclair Lewis returned home to Minnesota to work on his novel Elmer Gantry, published in the spring of 1927, people traveled from all over just to look at him. Magazines boomed too. Advertising revenues leapt 500% in the decade, and many publications of lasting importance made their debut. Reader's Digest in 1922, Time in 1923, The American Mercury and Smart Set in 1924, The New Yorker in 1925. Time was perhaps the most immediately influential. Founded by two former Yale classmates, Henry Luce and Britton Haddon, it was very popular but wildly inaccurate. It described Charles Neungesser, for instance, as having lost an arm, a leg, a chin during the war, which was not merely incorrect in all particulars, but visibly so, since Neungesser could be seen every day in newspaper photographs with a full set of limbs and an incontestably bechinned face. Time was noted for its repetitious devotion to certain words, swart, nimble, gimlet-eyed, and to squash neologisms like cinematict and cinemactress. It also had a fondness for odd, distorted phrases, so that in the nick of time became, without embarrassment, in time's nick. Above all, it had a curious Germanic affection for inverting normal word order and packing as many nouns, adjectives, and adverbs as possible into a sentence before bringing in a verb. Or, as Walcott Gibbs put it in a famous New Yorker profile of Luce, backward ran the sentences until reeled the mind. Despite all their up-to-the-minute swagger, Luce and Haddon were deeply conservative. They would not, for instance, employ women for any job above the level of secretary or office assistant. Above all, the 1920s was a golden age for newspapers. Newspaper sales in the decade rose by about a fifth to 36 million copies a day, or 1.4 newspapers for every household. New York City alone had 12 daily papers, and almost all other cities worthy of the name had at least two or three. More than this, in many cities, readers could now get their news from a new revolutionary type of publication that completely changed people's expectations of what daily news should be, the tabloid. Tabloids focused on crime, sports, and celebrity gossip, and in so doing gave all three an importance considerably beyond any they had enjoyed before. A study in 1927 showed that tabloids devoted between a quarter and a third of their space to crime reports, up to 10 times more than the serious papers did. It was because of their influence that the quiet but messy murder of a man like Albert Snyder could become national news. The tabloid, both as a format and as a way of distilling news down to its salacious essence, had been around for a quarter of a century in England, but no one had thought to try it in the United States until two young members of the Chicago Tribune publishing family, Robert R. McCormick and his cousin Joseph Patterson, saw London's Daily Mirror while serving in England during the First World War and decided to offer something similar at home when peace came. The result was the Illustrated Daily News, launched in New York in June 1919, price 2 cents. The concept was not an immediate hit. Circulation at one point fell to 11,000, but gradually the Daily News built a devoted following, and by the mid-20s it was far and away the best-selling newspaper in the country, with a circulation of 1 million, more than double that of the New York Times. Such success inevitably inspired imitators. First came the New York Daily Mirror from William Randolph Hearst in June 1924, followed 3 months later by the wondrously dreadful Evening Graphic. The Graphic was the creation of an eccentric, bushy-haired businessman named Bernard McFadden, who had started life rather more prosaically, some 50 years earlier, as a Missouri farm boy named Bernard McFadden. McFadden was a man of strong and exotic beliefs. He didn't like doctors, lawyers, or clothing. He was powerfully devoted to bodybuilding, vegetarianism, the rights of commuters to a decent rail service, and getting naked. He and his wife frequently bemused their neighbors in Englewood, New Jersey, among them Dwight Morrow, a figure of some centrality to this story, as will become apparent, by exercising naked on the lawn. McFadden's commitment to healthfulness was so total that when one of his daughters died of a heart condition, he remarked, "It's better she's gone. She'd only have disgraced me." Well into his 80s, he could be seen walking around Manhattan carrying a 40-pound bag of sand on his back, as a way of keeping fit. He lived to be 87. As a businessman, he seems to have dedicated his life to the proposition that where selling to the public is concerned, no idea is too stupid. He built three separate fortunes. The first was as the inventor of a cult science he called physcultopathy, which featured strict adherence to his principles of vegetarianism and strength through bodybuilding, with forays into nakedness for those who dared. The movement produced a chain of successful health farms and related publications. In 1919, as an outgrowth of the latter, McFadden came up with an even more inspired invention, the Confession magazine. True Story, the flagship of this side of his operations, soon had monthly sales of 2.2 million. All the stories in True Story were candid and juicy, with a yeasty undercurrent of sexual excitation, in the words of one satisfied observer. It was McFadden's proud boast that not a word in True Story was fabricated. This claim caused McFadden a certain amount of financial discomfort when a piece in 1927 called The Revealing Kiss, set in Scranton, Pennsylvania, turned out, by unfortunate chance, to contain the names of 8 respectable citizens of that fair city. They sued, and McFadden was forced to admit that True Story's stories were not in fact true at all, and never had been. When tabloids became the rage, McFadden launched The Graphic. Its most distinguishing feature was that it had almost no attachment to truth or even, often, a recognizable reality. It conducted imaginary interviews with people it had not met and ran stories by figures who could not possibly have written them. When Rudolph Valentino died in 1926, it produced a series of articles by him from beyond the grave. The Graphic became famous for a form of illustration of its own invention called the composograph, in which the faces of newsworthy figures were superimposed on the bodies of models who had been posed on sets to create arresting tableaux. The most celebrated of these visual creations came during annulment proceedings, earlier in 1927, between Edward W. Daddy Browning and his young and dazzlingly erratic bride, affectionately known to all as Peaches, when the Graphic ran a photo showing, without any real attempt at plausibility, Peaches standing naked in the witness box. The Graphic sold an extra 250,000 copies that day. The New Yorker called the Graphic a grotesque fungus, but it was a phenomenally successful fungus. By 1927, its circulation was nearing 600,000. For conventional newspapers, these were serious and worrying numbers. Most responded by becoming conspicuously more like tabloids themselves, in spirit if not presentation. Even the New York Times, though still devotedly solemn and grey, found room for plenty of juicy stories throughout the decade and covered them with prose that was often nearly as feverish. So now, when a murder like that of Albert Snyder came along, the result across all newspapers was something like a frenzy. It hardly mattered that the perpetrators were spectacularly inept, so much so that the writer and journalist Damon Runyon dubbed it the dumbbell murder case, and that they were not particularly attractive or imaginative. It was enough that the case involved lust, infidelity, a heartless woman, and a sash weight. These were the things that sold newspapers. The Snyder Gray case received more column inches of coverage than any other crime of the era, and would not be exceeded for column inches until the trial of Bruno Hauptmann for the kidnapping of Charles Lindbergh's baby in 1935. In terms of its effect on popular culture, even the Lindbergh kidnapping couldn't touch it. Trials in 1920s America were often amazingly speedy. Gray and Snyder were arraigned, indicted by a grand jury, and in the dock barely a month after their arrest. A carnival atmosphere descended on the Queens County Courthouse, a building of classical grandeur in Long Island City. 130 newspapers from across the nation and as far afield as Norway sent reporters. Western Union installed the biggest switchboard it had ever built, bigger than any used for a presidential convention or World Series. Outside the courthouse, lunch wagons set up along the curb, and souvenir sellers sold tie pins in the shape of sash weights for 10 cents each. Throngs of people turned up daily hoping to get seats inside. Those who failed seemed content to stand outside and stare at the building, knowing that important matters that they could not see or hear were being decided inside. People of wealth and fashion turned up too. Among them, the Marquess of Queensberry and the unidentified wife of a U.S. Supreme Court justice. Those fortunate enough to get seats inside were allowed to come forward at the conclusion of proceedings each day and inspect the venerated exhibits in the case, the sash weight, picture wire, and bottle of chloroform that featured in the evil deed. The News and Mirror ran as many as 8 articles a day on the trial. If any especially riveting disclosures emerged during the day, that, for instance, Ruth Snyder on the night of the murder had received Judd Gray in a blood-red kimono, Special editions were rushed into print, as if war had been declared. For those too eager or overcome to focus on the words, the Mirror provided 160 photographs, diagrams, and other illustrations during the 3 weeks of the trial. The Daily News, near 200. For a short while, one of Gray's lawyers was one Edward Riley, who would later gain notoriety by defending Bruno Hauptmann in the Lindbergh baby kidnapping trial. But Riley, who was a hopeless drunk, was fired or resigned at an early stage.